Chapter 8, Going to Mexico. Over time, the Sufis became a mere memory, and the couple experienced life in San Francisco in their usual innocent way, free from worry. They were fairly successful at nearly everything, despite each being ever so slightly dysfunctional. Steve and Maria had some next-door neighbors who had lived in Mexico during the 60s in Jalapa, a little town near Puerto Vallarta. The older couple spoke for hours about their experiences in Jalapa. They also discussed going to the state of Oaxaca in Mexico to eat magic mushrooms. They both were straight now that they were older, and they'd experienced flashbacks and other such residual effects after they'd stopped taking drugs. Beyond that, they wouldn't elaborate. They had learned to think back on the good times without becoming attached to them. Steve and Maria didn't notice or understand this incongruity, and right or wrong, decided to take a vacation from music and, like their friends, go to the mushroom country of Mexico. Steve and Maria prepared to go to Oaxaca to try these magic mushrooms. They went, like most young people do when they go to Mexico, with backpacks and no more. They planned to travel by second-class train most of the way. It was an exciting journey. They met a lot of friendly people on the trains. They shared food, and though they relied on Maria's Spanish, Steve tried to learn Spanish as well. When they reached a little town near mushroom country called Teotihuacan, they stayed overnight and spent the next day in the plaza. That night, planning to take a bus to the mountains, they met a young American at the bus station whose face had a pasty, drawn appearance, and he mumbled to himself. A woman who was with him repeated, "Slow down, take a deep breath, and think." Steve and Maria didn't know how to get to Huatla, so they asked him. He said he and his wife were on their way there and he could give Steve and Maria directions. He stuttered when he spoke. The man then spoke under his breath, saying something that sounded like, "Ongos must be kosher, just like ham, hit the nail with a hammer." Steve asked what he was talking about, unaware that the other young man might be mentally challenged. Pardoning himself, the young man said, "Don't mind me. Sometimes I babble when I don't have my curandero medicine. I was debating whether mushrooms are kosher. That's what happens to me when I'm decompensating. I get obtuse. And yes, I am Jewish." "You take curandero medicine for your decompensating? What does curandero give you?" probed Steve. "Do you mean you have a mental disability and the medicine man gives you something for that?" The young man nodded. "It's a long story." He motioned to his companion. "I came here about a year ago with my wife, Karen, hoping that the mushrooms or the Indians could cure me of my mental illness. The pills I took in the U.S. really didn't help. I was diagnosed as schizoaffective and my meds were very ineffective, no pun intended. So I came here and the Indians gave me their cure for mental illness, which has worked miraculously. I was very ineffective and can't think clearly when I don't eat my curandero medicine. Pardon me now. What did you want me to tell you?" "I've already forgotten." The other man sounded lost and incoherent. "What does curandero give you?" Steve asked impatiently. He wondered whether this man really knew what he was doing, getting an Indian to cure him. "Oh yes, I met an Indian who said he had some rare Indica Codis records. These records are hieroglyphic paintings from time of the conquistadors and earlier. The monks of the Spaniards had copied some and destroyed most of the others. The one that the curandero had hidden away told of a ritual that had been handed down to him from Indian warriors of long ago. They had been hired to fight a war, but they were all mentally challenged and were very poor warriors, unfit for battle. A great curandero came to them and cured them. To eat, he gave them the worm that lives in rotting mushrooms. The worm doesn't get them high, but just stops the humiliation of the disease, because the worm and the worm god taught them humility. Then they fought their battle and won. It's sort of a violent story, but it proves a point. I'm a pacifist and my battle is purely psychic." He also said that it's like fighting fire with fire. A worm lives a very humiliating life crawling around, much like a person with a mental illness does. They both are unable to be erect in their ways. With the worms in your system, it's like getting accustomed to going about all things slowly, like a turtle or a snail instead of manically rushing about. You don't think quick when you take the worms, but you learn how to face your humiliation in an upright fashion. With a lean look on his face, he peered closely at Steve. "I forget, did you want directions to the nearest store?" Karen said, "We're taking him to Watla, Paul." She turned to Steve. "Don't worry, he'll be better off than Popeye with his spinach after he eats the worms." She shook her head and smiled. "I know it's a leap of faith to believe such a crazy story, but it's all true. I know it sounds psychotic, but it is real. I'm not some New Age cultist who believes in witchcraft and things. Quite the contrary. I studied pharmacology in college. I once did a study in folk medicine, and I know a lot of their cures are hoaxes." Her eyes narrowed with conviction. "But this works. We're going to the mountains to have a curandero in Huatla collect a supply of mushrooms with worms on them. We live here in Teotihuacan, and we usually keep the worms frozen in the refrigerator. But when we left for Mexico City for a few days, we somehow left the refrigerator unplugged, and all the worms rotted. I don't completely follow the curandero's beliefs, but what he does is he prays to the worm god for good worms and goes out picking mushrooms, then letting them rot. We take them home and freeze them. Paul wrote a poem about the worms the other day. Would you like to read it?" Steve said yes, although he was skeptical of the whole thing. The poem read, "Infirm. Man seems a mere nothing when weakened and infirmed, as when he is colorless and pallid like the worm, and is called by some a demeaning term. It seems, though, if man can crawl, he ought to be able to stand up to his fate instead of stall. And rather than swagger and speak contemptuously with a drawl, that all he knows is the calamity of bankruptcy and the fall, he ought to be able to heed some religious call. When the man asks for a reward for doing much work, he is like the worm, not paid for fostering symbolic flowers of inspiration in the garden of delights. Man and worm, beleaguered, succeed in making fertile both the earth and the mind, as they mutually fight against failure, even though they are still struggling and groping. Through this thrashing about, they both find meaning in humility, as if coming in contact with the ground of being by connecting with the underpinning of the mind, coming from crawling and probing around in the earth in mortification. He begins to feel funny, and he finds this inflexible posture of society unmanly, striking him as odd, strange, and uncanny. Is it also that his boss looks at him impatiently when he moves at a snail's pace and can't stand erect, and because he has a small ego, the cold stare of his superior makes him feel like he has a personality defect? There is no justice for the forbearance of ill will or disease, and if it wasn't for the pill, the attendant man to the ill would be totally unaccommodating, as Caesar, not the layman, foots the bill. Being more ineffective than the patient who is listless and feeble, he sometimes wishes that he too could be like the worm who struggles and squirms to progress, because he, even though infirm, is never possessed by evil, and with a very strong will, the worm tries to look concerned about any earth-like upheaval, leaving no stone unturned. There is much power in a worm as it eats its way through humiliation, and even though affected, prevails against the heartless, resilient, and firm." After he reads it, Steve showed the poem to Maria. "This is pretty good," he said, surprised. Maria nodded. "It is a very good treatise on ineffectiveness. I'm just taken off guard trying to believe that a worm could cure mental illness. Sometimes I wonder whether I have some mental disability myself. Every once in a while, me and Steve have a bad experience with drugs. He complains about migraines a lot, and it has been getting steadily worse. I think we will eventually have to quit." The woman said apprehensively, "We rarely get high now because of that same reason. We both are dual diagnosis and have to avoid drugs." The next day, they arrived early in mushroom country. The fog at its thickest in the late summer reminded them a little of San Francisco, only much foggier. Paul and Karen put them in contact with the curandero they knew and sold them enough mushrooms for the trip they would take. Along the way, they met a young Jesus freak who wanted to try the mushrooms too. He had a tape that described the crucifixion of Jesus, which they listened to during their mushroom trip. They also decided to consume the mushrooms at night, the way the Indians do. The Jesus freak said timidly, "I've heard that peeking on magic mushrooms can be painful. I feel a little intimidated. I've tried psychedelics once before, and the abandonment on the self is a lot like Jesus feeling abandoned on the cross and asking, 'Lord, why hast thou forsaken me?'" They bought some copal to burn, an incense used in Mexico. Then they rented a shack and about 10 o'clock at night ate the mushrooms. At first, the sound of the tape describing Jesus' crucifixion sounded monotonous and dreary. But at the moment the psilocybin mushrooms started to affect all of them, Steve's mind faltered and his thoughts became paranoid. His mental gears ground to a halt. At once, most of the pain went away, but as he had experienced with the peyote, there was no ego. The voice on the tape recounted the tale of the soldiers who gambled for Jesus' robes. In a way, Steve felt like he was one of the soldiers gambling for a thread of truth or the fabric of belief. He couldn't keep his bare, naked soul covered. He expressed some of these thoughts aloud to Maria, finally able to speak after being muted in the beginning of the trip. I am gambling with myself for a fool's paradise, like the soldiers gambling for Jesus' clothes. It's a game of appearances. I'm not even happy. It's like all this experience is a dream and has not proven itself. It's a dream of mental fabrication. We're sort of gambling with our lives, trying to cover our nude consciences and souls with faith. Without faith, we have nothing. He felt stigmatized and bare to the world. The Jesus freak said, as if he were weighing a feather, Jesus' religion was a dream of faith in the making. It didn't become reality until Jesus died on the cross. Then the evidence of faith was Jesus on the cross. On drugs, the evidence of faith is death too, but only pseudo-death. It's the easy way out. It's not like we're real victims. I'm not so much dwelling on bliss, but more just counting my blessings that I'm not a victim. I love life, even though I'm dead to it right now. It doesn't seem like the truth comes until it's all over for the believer. I worry that drugs are going to ruin me. Maybe I'll go psychotic or something. Jesus knew he was going to be crucified. I feel like I could err very easily, and I sense that I could be crucified for my beliefs, too. Maria philosophized. That seems smarter than us. I guess someday we will go straight. I guess we are too aloof. But seriously, I think we are righteous enough to be able to keep our feet on the ground. Then again, you've probably also heard the saying, not one person is righteous, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. I wonder if Pontius Pilate found the mob presumptuous when they accused Jesus, and then he thought, Jesus is guilty because he carries the sins of the mob and thusly of mankind. We think in our little minds that on drugs we are dead to sin and are self-righteous, that we carry the sins of history in our superiority and have learned its lessons. Maybe not like Jesus, though. It is presumptuous and silly to assume we have dodged blame completely in this ego death. Steve pondered this. I feel like I've been hammered to the cross, but somehow I feel excessively proud and arrogant. I guess I am proud and arrogant. I suppose I should learn moderation, but at the moment I see no point in it. Which came first, the chicken or the egg, the hammer or the nail? Was Jesus innocent when he was nailed? Did they strike because he was a revolutionary? Or did he have some guilt that he must atone for? I find that the nails are symbols of cruelty, but it seems that by design the nail itself is the true evidence of rebellion and the mother of invention. Let's invent a better nail, Steve said jokingly, not fearing that he could be nailed at some unknown time for seemingly nothing. He didn't consider that man and sin were synonymous, just that a man must be a man, a nail must be a nail. They both were contrary to transcending cause and effect, or doing without doing, as preached in Zen. Nails do nail things. There was no escape from the fall, as there was no escape from cause and effect. Steve wondered if he was a rogue, or just young and mischievous. He considered Paul, who had babbled about him and the hammer and the nail. Steve wondered if he, too, was hitting that nail properly with the hammer. He suddenly realized what Paul had meant when he tried to be aware of what he was thinking. He wasn't changing his lifestyle, but unconsciously he knew that doing things hammer and nail is a duty in our world. I don't want to be like policemen and judges who carelessly hammer together judgments, nailing their prisoners quickly and unthinkingly. Maybe I am nailing the straight world too quickly. But maybe there's something out there for me, he thought with a glimmer of compassion. The Jesus freak pondered and said with finality, I think I have realized what my regimen of faith should be. I have learned about sacrifice with these drugs, but I have also seen that it could be my own downfall, too. Just before I left, I was offered a job to preach. I'm going to go straight and become a preacher. I will preach about sacrifice. Somehow I think that even though a regular sinner, or a person with mental illness, or even a criminal, has some varying amount of guilt and may humbly perform a sacrifice, like Christ did, by being contrite, they don't have to carry their contrition forever. Maybe they can't bear their own guilt, but the guilt of having crucified Christ is something we can all carry. Maybe they don't pay for all of it. Christ pays for their sin. But maybe we all pay some sort of sacrifice. In that way, we are all a little Christ-like. The morning after their journey to Huautla, Steve and Maria met up with the couple who lived in Teotihuacan. The color had returned to the young man's face. He was no longer pallid, and he looked happy and focused. "Did you eat any mushrooms?" the young man asked. His voice was strong and clear. Maria tried to relate their inexplicable, acute, almost violent experience with the Godhead that they had experienced. "I know it is all very presumptuous of me to think we have come so close to God, but we were with the Christ last night. We all must really have the mark of the beast." She was straight at the moment and felt controlled by the limitations of normality, which made her feel her own incompetence acutely. She tried to rationalize her experience and to feel contrite about humankind's ineptitude. They talked for a while, noticing that Paul no longer appeared mentally ill and spoke with eloquence. "You seem so normal now. Did you take your Curandero's medicine or something?" asked Steve. "Yes," Paul said. "The Indian had some left over that he usually gives his grandmother. He gave me enough from her bats for 2 or 3 days until he can collect some more. In a couple of weeks we will have collected enough for me to last through the winter," he explained. His speech was clear as a bell. "It's so nice to be able to focus." He hesitated a moment. "I'm very proud of my poem, Infirm. Karen told me you'd read it. You know, many writers aren't recognized until they pass away, when the worms eat at their flesh and soul. It's humbling to them and to humanity. The worms are affirmation of the trials and tribulations that follow us to our graves. The worms I eat are a way to cheat death and the ignorance that comes with it. I'm trying hard to become a famous writer and poet. These worms I eat have inspired me enough to have learned how to write over time." Steve and Maria parted company with the poet and walked around the pueblo. Later they wandered into a little restaurant and drank some of the locally grown mountain coffee as they had come down from the mushrooms of the night before. There they met another boisterous American accompanied by a loose-talking, strung-out girl. The man wore a sea captain's hat and looked tough. He seemed high on something other than the mushrooms and began to babble to Steve and Maria. As he downed the 180-proof hard liquor that the locals drink, they tried to make conversation with him. He swaggered about uncontrollably. "I'm higher than a kite," he said. "I took the mushrooms last night. I hated the high. It's so vainglorious. The high was bringing me down, so I mixed it with some ecstasy. That fixed it up great. I had a howling time." He paused to drink another shot of liquor. "I met God last night and lied to him about the truth," he chuckled. "The mushrooms didn't make me contrite, but actually more evasive about my carnal intentions. Pops up there in heaven thinks I'm a good boy," he said, snickering. He signaled for another drink and was given a milder Indian liquor called pulque. "I don't believe in the world's limitations, though. That's one thing I believe about psychedelics. It all traces back to when I was arrested for manslaughter and they dropped the charges," he sneered. "They said I wasn't responsible." Steve thought maybe they should just leave because this character was just too weird. His loose-looking girlfriend, who was also drunk and high, interrupted. "But actually, you fooled him, just like Cain fooled God in the beginning. He didn't actually kill Abel, he planned it. Hubby here planned all day, maybe even for a couple of days. He made it look like he accidentally hit the guy with a baseball bat while they were playing baseball. I lied and said I saw the whole thing." Her voice was slurry and incoherent. She giggled. "Have you ever heard that saying, if you forfeit the confidence of your fellow citizens, you can never regain their respect and esteem? It is true that you may fool all the people some of the time, you can even fool some of the people all the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time." She laughed hysterically. "I learned that in school." The guy wearing the captain's hat looked as if he would slap her. "Shut up, you're drunk. If we were back home, you could have blown our cover." Overcome by information overload, Steve and Maria just let it all slide. They thought they should turn him in, but the red tape of doing such a thing boggled their minds. Instead, they simply said, "Uh-huh," and let the other couple continue making a scene in the cafe. Too stoned to realize the chance he was taking, the guy with the captain's hat said in a loud, conspiratorial whisper that everyone in the cafe could hear, "I have a pound of cocaine. You want to buy some?" "No thanks," Steve said, looking around nervously. "We should get going," Maria broke in. Steve nodded and muttered vaguely about needing to get a head start on the next stage of their travels. They walked quickly out of the restaurant. "Did you hear what he said about going beyond limitations?" Maria said when they reached the corner. "Psychedelics don't teach that you can challenge the limitations of the law. At least I don't think so. If we were in the U.S., I'd probably snitch on him, but there's no police here with jurisdiction over him." "They must have been really stoned out of their minds to actually talk about that kind of thing in public," commented Steve. They returned to their shack to find the federales waiting inside to capture them. Their expressions were sober and menacing. One of them spoke broken English. "We will search your belongings." They found a few measly marijuana seeds. Steve convinced them to take him and leave Maria, since the seeds were in his backpack, not Maria's. At the local jail, the federales questioned Steve. "We are looking for someone who deals cocaine. We suspect that you or somebody you know has a large quantity of it." Terrified of ending up in a Mexican jail, Steve blurted, "I met some people in town who said they had some cocaine. I only saw them once, just in the restaurant. If I lead you to them, will you let me go?" The federale's eyes gleamed. "If you give me a little tip, I might." Fortunately, Steve had brought a little emergency money. He reached into his wallet and surreptitiously slipped the federale $200. The federale said, "If we find them and the cocaine, we will let you go. You might want to remember that smoking marijuana is not permitted here in Oaxaca. Only eating the hongo is permissible." By evening, Steve was released. He found Maria, and they hurried out of Mushroom Country.